In order to show you how a big symphony orchestra is put together, Benjamin Britten has written a big piece of music, which is made up of smaller pieces that show you all the separate parts of the orchestra. These smaller pieces are called variations, which means different ways of playing the same tune. First of all, he lets us hear the tune, or the theme, which is a beautiful melody by the much older British composer, Henry Purcell. Here is Purcell's theme, played by the whole orchestra together. You hear the four different families of the orchestra playing the same Purcell theme in different ways. First, we hear the woodwind family, the flutes, the oboes, the clarinets, and the bassoons. Here comes the brass family, the trumpets, the horns, the trombones, and the tuba. Mr. Britten arranges the Purcell theme for the string family, the violins, the violas, the cellos, and the double basses, and of course the harp. Finally, the percussion family. All those drums and gongs and things you hit. After this, you will hear the theme by Purcell, played once more in its original form by all four families together. That is, the whole orchestra.
So that is a piece of music from something called The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, which if you were of a certain age, you might have listened to in your music classes. Probably not a lot of us are of that age, but anyway. thought it was just a really interesting way to think about music, and but I'm not going to talk a lot about it right now. So just keep that in the back of your mind, how orchestras come together, and we'll come back to it a little bit later. So there's sort of four things that I want to, four ideas, that's one of them, three more ideas that I just want to introduce, and I'm going to try and tie them all together, hopefully. So just bear with me if this seems like this is kind of going in weird directions, not connected directions. It will tie together eventually. Oops. I also forgot my Bible this morning. How terrible. So I'm using modern technology to read to you from the Bible, because it's all on the internet now. So the first idea is probably one of the most difficult in the Bible. It's the story of the Tower of Babel. So we're going to go into that, because it's fun to do difficult things sometimes. So I'm just going to read it to you here. This is from Genesis 11. At one time, all the people of the world spoke the same language and used the same words. As the people migrated to the east, they found a plain in the land of Babylonia and settled there. The They began saying to each other, "Let's make bricks and harden them with fire." In this region, bricks were used instead of stone, and tar was used for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let's build a great city for ourselves, with a tower that reaches into the sky. This will make us famous and keep us from being scattered all over the world." But the Lord came down and looked at the city and the tower and the people, and the tower that the people were building. "Look," he said, "the people are uniting, and they all speak the same language. After this, nothing they set out to do will be impossible for them. Come, let's go down and confuse the people with different languages. Then they won't be able to understand each other." In that way, the Lord scattered them all over the world, and they stopped building the city. And this is why the city was called Babel, because that is where the Lord confused the people with different languages. And this way, he scattered them all over the world. So, this is definitely one of those strange passages that makes you kind of scratch your head. I mean, when you look at the situation, all of the people on earth at the time, the story tells us, spoke the same language, they lived close to each other, and they were looking for ways to work together. From a perspective of sort of 21st century Western culture, it seems like they've got a pretty good thing going on. I mean, everybody is the same race, so there's no racism. Everyone speaks the same language, so no one is at a disadvantage when it comes to communicating. And everyone is looking to live centrally in sort of high-density towers, which, you know, doesn't God see the problem of urban sprawl a few thousand years later? You know, and so it seems like this might have been the only instance in the history of humanity where we had world peace. But God decides he's going to go down and create division. He creates different languages, he spreads everyone apart. And really, it seems like he's laying the groundwork for thousands of years of cultural oppression that we sort of call human history. And, I mean, God does not come off as a great guy in this story. He looks kind of petty and small. He says, "They've just begun to take advantage of their common language and political unity. Just think what they will do later." I mean, political unity? Could you imagine what the world would be like, or what our country would be like, if any of our leaders had political unity? We really could actually do anything. So really, what's the problem here? Is what I sort of think. Thank God, what's the problem here? Why are you breaking up the band when they're still writing hits? So it's a tough question, and I don't have an answer for you. So sorry if that's what you came here for. But we're going to keep digging into some other stories, and maybe we'll come up with something that makes a little bit of sense. So we're going to leave that. We're going to jump ahead a few thousand years to Jesus. This is one of those new phones with the fingerprint thing. Doesn't always work so well. Anyway, we're going to move to Jesus and his disciples. And this is a time where Jesus and Peter are kind of chatting, and Jesus asks him, the people say that I am?" Peter says, "They think you're Elijah or one of the prophets." And he asks Peter, "Who do you think I am?" And Peter's you know, gives the right answer, and he says, "You know, you're the Messiah." And so Jesus says to him that, you know, that didn't come from your own mind. That was something that God taught you, or that revealed to you. And then he goes on to say this: "I tell you the truth, whatever you forbid on earth will be forbidden in heaven, and whatever you permit on earth will be permitted in heaven. I also tell you this." This is the wrong one. This is why you need a real Bible, I think. Okay. Now he's just talking to John. We'll go back to the other one in a second. Jesus replied, "You are blessed, Simon, son of John, because my Father in heaven has revealed this to you. You did not learn this from any human being. Now I say to you that you are Peter, which means rock, and upon this rock I will build my church, and all the powers of hell will not conquer it. And I will give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you forbid on earth will be forbidden in heaven. Whatever you permit on earth will be permitted in heaven." Now, this is actually quite an important passage, sort of in the history of church development, especially if you come from the Catholic tradition. Catholicism often points to this moment as Christ's sort of official creation of the papal succession, sort of the church, and as well the notion of papal infallibility. So essentially what those mean is that whoever the Pope happens to be, he's not just sort of a guy who's been appointed. He's actually the mystical direct descendant of Peter, the disciple. And that he's been giving the Pope, whoever the Pope is, has been given the same power that Jesus gave to Peter. And he has that same power in heaven and on earth. So, whoever the Pope is, whatever he decrees, is ultimately the right answer, right? He's got the power to bind and forbid and permit on heaven and on earth, which basically makes him sort of a god on earth. Which also makes it kind of tough to debate with him, because basically, by the logic of papal infallibility, everything he says is right, because of the fact that he's saying it. So that's probably why, if you look through the history of the church, there's many instances of simultaneous popes, because someone didn't agree, and so he said, no, I'm the pope now. And this guy said, no, I'm the pope. And anyway, it's fascinating. If you ever look at the church history, just how many lines there are. But so this idea of permitting and forbidding, it's also been called binding and loosening. And so I just want to dig into that idea quickly, because it's actually an important one within sort of the history of the Jewish tradition. It basically comes from the rabbis, who would have had this power to bind and loosen. It was basically another way of saying interpreting. So the rabbis were teachers who would interpret the scriptures for the common sort of people. They had spent years studying the Torah, and so were the ones who were qualified to give these educated interpretations about God, what God was actually trying to say through these writings. And there were many different rabbis at the time, and they were all sort of traveling around, and if you found one that you liked, you would become his follower, and then you would, if you found one you didn't like, you would sort of scorn that one and say, this one doesn't know what he's talking about, and you'd become a student of this rabbi. It's not actually that different from sort of the way modern churches work or denominations, right? You find one that sort of falls in line with what you believe, or your beliefs fall in line with what they are teaching, and you go with that, and you sort of say, well, there's other churches, they're fine, but they're not as good as this one, and, you know, this is how we work. Now, what's really interesting about this idea is that Jesus is considered a rabbi by his followers. And the reason this is odd is because rabbis, as I said, were highly educated. They were the sort of upper echelon of the intellectual society at the time. And Jesus was really not much more than a peasant from this sort of backwater town called Nazareth, who was most likely functionally illiterate. And that didn't really matter to his followers, of course, because they were all peasants as well, who were mostly illiterate. And so, you know, he was a better speaker, and they followed him. But this does make these statements unusual, because basically this guy would have had no place in the society to be able to make proclamations like this about anyone. To sort of the power structure of the time, to these other rabbis, this would have been laughable. It actually would have probably been like if you were standing over there and you heard, say, Zoe talking to Joah and was like, by the way, Joe, I got you a new job. You're going to be teaching physics at the U of M starting in January. So just go in and, you know, check in and teach. Because Zoe doesn't have the power to give that job. And Joe is definitely not qualified for that job. I don't think. Maybe he is. I know he's a smart. But do you think university level teaching at this point? Maybe when he's...
TED Talk next week.
Maybe when he's five. Anyway. So it's about equivalent to that, right? You would think that's... No way should this be happening here, you know. But this is essentially what Jesus is doing. When the Jewish leaders would have read the Gospels years later, they probably also would have thought, this is still crazy. Who is this guy to say this sort of thing? Now, I'm going to go back to that passage I started reading before, and I'm going to read it at the right time now. Where is it here? Okay. So now this is Jesus. This is two chapters later in Matthew. He's with all of his followers now, all of his disciples. And he's talking to them again. This is sort of within a much larger conversation. And he says, very close to the same thing. He says, I tell you the truth, whatever you forbid on earth will be forbidden in heaven, and whatever you permit on earth will be permitted in heaven. I also say this, if two of you agree here on earth concerning anything you ask, my Father in heaven will do it for you. For where two or three are gathered together as my followers, I am among them." So he's using pretty much the same language that he was using with Peter, but now he's spread it out to the rest of the disciples. Something tells me Peter at this point is probably like, hey, what's the deal here? I thought this was my gig. But anyway. But this totally changes sort of this idea that we just set up. And if you're a diehard Catholic, which you probably aren't if you're here, because you should be at Mass, you might also be thinking this kind of throws a monkey wrench into the whole idea of the Pope and papal infallibility. And that's because that's exactly what this does. With a few sentences, Jesus is completely dismantling the hierarchical system that had existed within Judaism for thousands of years. He's laying the groundwork for a democratic religious system, a system wherein equality and consensus determine dogma rather than a centralized power. Now, of course, the church didn't do so well at this, and it still instituted a central leader, set up a hierarchy, and they gave that central leader the power of God. That's in the Catholic Church, and which lasted, you know, hundreds of years, and then people broke off from that, and they did the exact same thing. So even in our sort of, non-Catholic traditions, we operate in the same way. We appoint pastors and denominational leaders, and we allow their interpretations to become more important than the original words that they're interpreting. So we're going to move on again. We're going to jump. keep that all in mind. The third thing I want to talk about is actually Canada, this our country. And I want to talk about it both as a nation and as a notion, because it is both things. I started thinking about this a few years ago. Jane and I went on a trip to Ottawa. And one of the things we saw there was this sort of animated history of Canada that was projected on the front wall of the Parliament building. And it was really interesting, and it sort of looked at the growth of the country, the accomplishments. It also looked at the mistakes, and it really delved into this sort of central ethos of what Canada is and what we strive to be. On that same trip, we also visited the Canadian Museum of Civilization, which tracks the development of our country right back from Aboriginal peoples living here in pre-European North America, right up to our common era. Our contemporary here. And it's actually a really great museum. If you're ever in Ottawa, go check it out. You have to cross the river to haul, but it's worth it. So now, after both of these experiences, I had the same feeling. And it was the idea, or there's a feeling that Canada is a really great idea for a country. And possibly the greatest idea for a country that's ever existed. And I don't say that out of like some sense of rah-rah patriotism or something like that. I'm not a diehard patriotic person. I don't really buy into it. But that's a whole other discussion. But I say that because I say that it's a good idea because I think there's a great divide between this notion of Canada and the nation of Canada. As an actual nation, almost consistently, we've really failed miserably. I think especially in the last 10 to 15 years, probably, to live up to this ideal. Within just the last 10 years, we've really lost our standing in the world. We're no longer leaders in regard to the environment or social justice or human rights or even racism. In a lot of ways, we've become politically corrupt, financially myopic, and socially inept. And I don't mean socially inept in like we're awkward in conversations. I mean, the tenets that the country was built on, this democratic, social democracy, we've really fallen behind on living up to that. We're not living up to the sort of ideal that I remember reading about in my grade 5 social studies textbook. Not that we ever really have lived up to that ideal. We can't point to a certain time in our history and say, this is when Canada was the most at its best Canadian or whatever. But I think that it is a noble ideal. I think it's a great idea for a country. And the one thing I want to think about in regards to what we're talking about today is the idea which has always struck me as really interesting, and that's the idea of multiculturalism. That's the idea that for a nation to be strong, it should celebrate the differences of its citizens. Now, this is a unique idea in the history of human civilization. For most of human history, when one nation took over another, the conquered nation needed to adopt the laws and practices of its conqueror, or it would have to face some pretty steep consequences. The Roman Empire wasn't nailing people to crosses by the thousands every year because they really respected the diversity of all these countries that their armies were trampling. No, they believed, the Roman society believed itself to be the zenith of human civilization and culture, and so were forcing everyone else to be like them. Any threat against Roman supremacy was met with violence. And there was definitely no hope for establishing sort of, if you went to Rome, the city itself, it's not like you could set up your own cultural center there. That whole phrase, when in Rome, do as the Romans, wasn't just good advice. It was pretty much, do or die. And then as we look back, as we keep moving through history, we can see in the Middle Ages and into the colonial period just how prevalent this idea is. When Britain was going around conquering the world, one of the first things they would do is build schools and churches, and they want so that they can make sure that their idea of, or that everyone that they conquered was learning what it meant to be human in a civilized society. And if that didn't work, well, England had the biggest guns, so they could take care of the problem. And that's why, in many parts of the world, our own included, the word colonization is often synonymous with the word genocide. But anyway, enough downer stuff. I'm sorry. The point is that Canada, after many horrific racial persecutions, followed by abysmal attempts at racial assimilation, we arrived at the conclusion that as a nation made up of mostly immigrants, we should stop trying to create a unified image of the quintessential Canadian. And instead, accept that a Canadian is many different things. And that each iteration of that is equal, relevant, and as beautiful as each other. Can you fire that up, Brent? And so, because we believe that, and because different leaders, Trudeau was one of them who instituted this Multiculturalism Act, Mulroney also had it added to the Charter, we live in this world where we live in a country that doesn't have sort of a uniform image. So we can't say that just this is a Canadian. We can't say this is what a Canadian looks like. We can't just say that these are Canadians. These are what they look like. but we also, these are Canadians. And these are Canadians. And these are Canadians. And these are Canadians. And these are Canadians. No matter what some parts of our country are trying to change. So we're a diverse group of people, and that is worth celebrating. But it also creates enormous challenges because it causes us to be functionally vague, which causes disputes over what it means to be culturally relevant or appropriate or politically correct. Unlike our neighbors to the south, we can't hold up some ideal. We can't show the Mountie and say that this is what a Canadian is. In the States, it's getting harder and harder to say this is an American anyway because the image is becoming out of date more and more every year. We can't even come close to that and say this is a Canadian. If you don't fit into this, you're welcome to stay, but keep to yourself if you don't want any trouble. Canadian multiculturalism is an attempt to create a society wherein diverse people groups don't just begrudgingly coexist, but rather accept and learn and even celebrate other races and cultures. I think the best example of this happens in our own city every year when we get together and do Folklorama. Here's a chance for all of us to learn about each other and celebrate each other together, each other's backgrounds and cultures. It forces people to break free from sort of the homogenized nature of groups segregated by race and creed. And thus it breaks down the biggest enemy to human interaction, which is hate of the unknown other. Okay, so those were the four things. We're going to start working back through them. I promise we'll be out of here by two. No, just kidding. let's take a step back and return to what Jesus was talking about with his disciples, this binding and loosening that he was talking about. Because it seems to me that he's kind of up to something similar as to what Canada is doing in multiculturalism. Now, whether or not Jesus was planning to establish a new religion is highly debatable and probably not the case. So really, what he was doing was he was trying to enlighten his followers to a better way of living, not just a better way of doing religion. He was explaining that humanity works better when there isn't one central figure that makes all the decisions and passes down all those decisions to the people through whatever force is necessary. Instead, Jesus is trying to teach his followers about communal agreement. He says, wherever two or three are gathered in his name, he is there. And so is the power of God. Now, we hear that a lot, but it's actually kind of astonishing that he's saying this. Jesus is saying, for the first time, that God is not a dictator. He wants to work with us, hear our ideas, and build something great out of diversity. Yes, God has the power. I'm not saying he doesn't, but he's not hoarding that power. Now, within the church, just like anywhere else, this idea comes fraught with challenges. However, it seems like God wants us to be somewhat divided, to hold differing opinions so that we can learn to be open-minded to the thoughts and concerns of others, and essentially to be free of this really dark thing called ideology. Now, I don't know if ideology, it's a pretty common term, but it's basically the dark side of idealism. It's what happens when your ideals or what you think is good sort of shifts into laws and rules. And basically, ideology is knowing the answer to before the question's asked, right? So we hear a lot about political ideology, governments just at a standstill because they can't see past sort of what they see as the only option. Now, when we hold in this sort of system that Jesus is talking about, we can't hold fast to an ideology because our ideas of what we think is absolutely true are constantly being challenged by compelling arguments. Jesus gave us the power to bind and loose so that each group of people seeking him can find a way that works for that group. For a group of people living in sort of an isolated tract of land in the Manitoba wilderness, say in 1915, the pomp and ceremony of, say, the High Anglican tradition or the Catholic tradition probably wouldn't have made a lot of sense. For, say, a congregation of Japanese believers or something like that in urban Tokyo, maybe the highly emotional traditions of, say, a Southern Baptist probably would feel a little awkward. And for a small group gathering in a village in Swaziland, the sort of intellectual discourse, the sort of thing we do here, might not be that effectual. And so that's why this is not the only image of Christianity. But this is also what Christianity looks like. And this is what Christianity looks like. And this guy is what Christianity looks like. And this is what Christianity looks like. This is one of the oldest Christian churches in the world. This is from the Ethiopian church. And this is what Christianity looks like. This is the new pope. And this is an image of Christianity, the Chartres Cathedral in France. This is an image of Christianity. You may have seen it on Main Street, the North End. This is also an image of Christianity. I think this actually got struck by lightning a few years ago. I remember reading, so maybe it wasn't God's favorite image. Anyway, it's still an image. This is still how people connect. And this is an image of Christianity. This, by the way, is the St. Vladimir and Olga Cathedral in the North End of Winnipeg. Just in case you ever thought there was nothing to do over there. It's a beautiful building. Now, so this is not to say that everyone is right or that everyone is wrong. In this search, people lose their way. Some churches begin to worship themselves. Some leaders replace Christ as a figurehead. Some pastors twist Christ's message of love into unabashed rhetoric of hate and exclusion, which is awful and really hard to stomach. Sometimes I wonder why all the why an all-powerful God sort of keeps the most hate-filled pastors in the public eye, but he does. And that's why I'm not God. Thank God. Nobody's perfect, but God knows this, and he still left the church to us to take care of. He left it to all of us to take care of together. This mass of diverse, petty, political, power-hungry, pig-headed, ignorant, simple-minded, self-interested, easily distracted wanderers known as humanity. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And so that leads me back to Babel. Maybe God isn't quite as petty and small-minded as he seems to us with our limited ability to understand his ways. I guess that God could already see what happens when only one voice is loud enough to be heard. Consider some of the loudest voices in our culture. It's pretty scary. Even God operates by committee, after all. He works in three parts, chasing after what is good and true and beautiful. Difference of opinion is only a problem when one opinion is trying to crush another, not when two ideas are held up against each other in the hope of finding an idea that's better than either one of them could be alone. Dissonance can actually be a major advantage when everyone involved is going the same direction. A group of 100 musicians, all playing the piccolo, would probably be easy to write, but it would hardly make a great symphony. In a successful orchestra, the strings are not working to drown out the percussion. The brass doesn't want to keep the woodwinds from being heard. Each family of the orchestra wants its part to complement the others, so that the overall sound of everyone together is as beautiful as the composer intended it to be. I'm going to throw another definition at you now that we're back into the realm of symphonies and classical music. It's a musical term, and it's a type of piece that can be written. It's a fugue. I don't know if you guys know what a fugue is. I'm going to read you the sort of textbook definition, then I'll try and break it down a bit. So a fugue is a musical composition in which one or two themes are repeated or imitated by successfully entering voices and contrapuntally developed in a continuous interweaving of voice parts. Contrapuntally is a big word. It means through counterpoint. Counterpoint is when you have two melodies sort of going at the same time and doing different things. So basically, a fugue, the simplest version would be, say, row, row, row your boat, right? You know this, row, row, row your boat, row, row, row your boat. Everybody sings, and eventually you all go down the stream together. So you have, in that case, the same melody sung at different times, layering over each other, and it creates something that if you just sang it once, you couldn't accomplish. Fugues are a little more complicated. They tend to shift melodies and timings and all that kind of stuff. If you're ever interested in I'm going to play a fugue in a minute, so you'll be able to hear one, but there's some great stuff out there. So this idea is interesting to me because I can't help but think that what sounds to us like an enormous, dissonant, ugly mess of competing theologies, endless debates, and pointless rhetoric sounds to God like something closer to a fugue. After all, if we begin on the assumption that another person's set of ideas has been born out of the same earnest seeking after the truth that our own ideas have been, then we have to accept that there is some divine truth somewhere behind what is being said, no matter how off the mark those statements may sound to us and our set of ideas. You know, maybe we're all speaking different languages, but it's reasonable to believe that God understands those languages and that they all sound equally beautiful to him. So we're going to bring this full circle. We're going to return to Benjamin Britten and Henry Purcell once more, so that for one thing I can play you a fugue so you kind of know what I'm talking about. So we're going to listen. There's no video again. Just listen to it and think about how the parts come together and think about all the voices over the centuries that have called out the name of God. Listen to how these parts blend and morph before becoming something quite spectacular. Something that would be impossible without the contribution of all the diverse instruments represented. And while you're doing that, think about God. whatever that looks like for you. Think about a being who is at once so far beyond us in wisdom and understanding, while at the same time is intimately involved and interested in every aspect of our lives. I'm going to play this, and then Luke, you can come up when it's done. So as you're thinking about that, as you're listening, think about how your part of the fugue sounds. Is it in tune? Are you overbearing? Are you too quiet? Is the song that you're playing one that you would want to listen to?
So you see, the composer Benjamin Britten has taken the whole orchestra apart. Now he puts it back together again in a fugue. The instruments come in one after another in the same order as before, beginning with the piccolo. And at the end, when all the instruments have finally come in, the brass will play old Henry Purcell's melody, while the other instruments go on playing young Benjamin Britten's fugue.